Very good. So what we're going to do this session from 3 to 4 is going to have the opportunity for asking deep questions. And I will be the MC because I'm the boss, the spiritual dictator of the Buddhist Society of West Australia. So any hard ones I'll give to Venerable Hasapanya and I'll take the easy ones. Okay? I'll take these ones to their hearts. But we should introduce and welcome the Honourable Janine Freeman, the member for Mirrabooka, who's always been a big supporter here. She's come along as well. And she for the election out of the getting the Labour Party over the line. That wasn't reported in the newspapers, but we all know that that's actually what happened. So anyone who supports the opposition, you have to go and get them to come here as well next time. That's how it works. Anyway, thanks to me for coming. So, very good. Because you know that I spend a lot of time just giving lectures, teaching, giving instructions. And people often say, especially, is this being live streamed overseas? Ah, excellent. So sometimes that people say that they haven't got enough time to ask questions, especially after the Friday night talk. So is the computer working? Is it able to ask questions? Very good. So anyone who is listening overseas, you're most welcome to ask any question you like, and it will go on to the computer, the laptop, and then it will come to me and I can answer it or get one of the other monks to answer it today. So, again, thank you all for coming. So, who is going to be brave enough to ask the first question? John, yes. If I wait for the microphone because those people overseas can hear it.
Ajahn, you do a lot of work spreading the Dharma so that we can all hear it, but these beautiful chants are all still in Pali, and we who don't know Pali don't know the chants, what they actually mean.
Okay, the Buddhist chanting. Should we translate it all into English? The problem is, if you understood what we were chanting, then I wouldn't ever be able to make mistakes anymore. Like we did this morning. So when it's in a foreign language, we can chant anything and you don't know. It's true, isn't it? You know that. This is monks, nuns, secrets. But mostly, it's not just the words of the chant, sometimes there's the oomph behind it. Because often when some of the really powerful chants, I know what they mean, and they're very, very powerful. So I'm listening to them when I'm chanting them, and that makes them very, very powerful. It is true that sometimes we miss hearing some great teachings, but still it still works if it's in a Pali language. And it also encourages you. John, you've got a brain. Why don't you learn some Pali? It's not that hard to learn. And it's just sometimes, if you learn some, it's not just a chance. You can read the books and read some of the stuff which the Buddha said in their own language. And it's amazing stuff. Really fascinating stuff when you can actually read it in the original language. And it's not that hard, John. But we have done a lot of chanting in the English language. We have the Metta Sutta, which we've done for a long time. We do that every day at the retreats. This is what should be done. And this is one of the problems there, that sometimes when we chant, people misunderstand. What is it? We have, let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will. People say, what have you got against the nuns? Let none through anger or ill will.
Actually, Dharma Sara, every Wednesday, actually we do in English chanting. We do the yoso in English.
Yes, but how can you do that when you come to my temple on Wednesday?
No, it's sometimes when we don't go to Vodayana, when we
are so Dharma Sara, we chant English. That's what you get up to when you don't come to.
So like, do the blessed one, the Lord,
that's what you get up to.
And then opposite all our reflections, we chant in Pali and English.
In Pali and English.
Yeah.
Oh.
We do.
Yeah. Well, we're doing ours in Australian. Not English. Okay, but we get your point. So, are you satisfied with the answer to that question? You should be, because remember the chant says, be contented and easily satisfied. Not proud, demanding in nature, John Fisher. Okay, come on, another question anyone would like to ask? Thank you for that question, John. Yes, you pa.
When we, the last breath, when
you die,
ready to die, what we should to put our mind state?
The last thought. Well, maybe we can ask one of the nuns that, because you're much closer than I am, aren't you?
The story about the
Vaisak Buddhist. Yeah. Okay. Very good. It is true. They say in Buddhism, your last thought as you pass away, that will determine where you are going to get reborn in your next life. So many of you know this because this is in one of my books, Lumbo. And the only time he'd ever go to. Now this set of because his wife would force him to go. Nation and listen. Somebody asked the question. It doesn't count that. I said, well, what? Just before you pass away, and after the Dhamma, businessman thought, rebirth. I don't need to keep precepts. I don't need to be good. Or donations. And this man didn't like doing that. So he thought, I can. But how? Wonderful solution. So as soon as he got back home, he renamed his eldest son Buddha. That on his deathbed, his son's duty to be with your parents when they die. So from that time on, he never went to the temple again, never gave any donations. Just play around, forget about virtue, because he knew all he needed to do was think about Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha before he died. Working perfectly. His deathbed. And there was his Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. As he looked at his three sons. My business. And that's. So, out of control. Really kind. You've always been ignorant. When you die, your last thought. Then a good person, a kind person. Yeah, you can't resist. It's also the case, being serious, as many of you know about the dying death. Shorter, but it's a pretty good 5 parsley. examples of that. And those are the ones which are really important. But another serious part to you in Buddhism, because people do feel that your last breath is really, your last thought is important, some people feel they should not take morphine. Because if you take morphine towards the end, it means that your mind is in a cloud and you just don't know what's happening. So how can you have a mindful thought at the very end? But the point is that even people in a coma, even people with dementia, or people who have morphine, your last moment is clear. Yes, you may be in a coma, but the last moments, you wake up. You get your clarity. The last time I mentioned this was in Renchi Hospital in Singapore on a seminar on death and dying. And there, I asked the doctors and nurses who were in palliative care, how many of you have witnessed a person in a coma or heavily sedated in morphine opening their eyes and becoming aware of the last moments? And quite a few of them put their hands up. It's actually a very common occurrence. There was a couple here. Actually, the sister would come here when her father was dying. Her and her other sister were by the bedside. I think it was in Charlie Gardner's hospital, holding their father's hand, who'd been unconscious for hours, just waiting for that last breath. And they were just holding their hands, just not really paying any attention, just waiting. They'd been waiting for hours for the last breath. And then without any warning, their father opened his eyes. He leant up, looked at his two daughters, who said, without any preparation, they just said, "We love you, Dad," in synchronicity. And then he fell down and died. And that's happened so many times. People told me those anecdotes. At the very end, we get clarity. So don't have to worry about the morphine. Please take it. Otherwise, it's very, very painful and very uncomfortable. You'll find you will come clear at the very, very end of your life. And there you can have your wonderful good thoughts. And of course, it's not just Buddha Dhamma Sangha, it's just let go of all of the people, all the loved ones, all of the possessions. Especially let go of all the remorse and hatred and unfinished business. Finish it, it's done. So that you can let go and be peaceful and die free, not clinging to anything in this world. That's always the best. So it's a strange thing that we have classes, you know, we go to school, we learn how to read and write, you know, we have lessons how to ride a bicycle, or how to eventually having examinations how to ride a car. You know, getting married, you can have lessons first of all to prepare yourself before marriage. You have a kid, you know, you go to classes, prenatal classes. We have so much information and so much training, but no one tells us how to die, which is one of those things which will happen to each one of us. And so it's really important to know how to die. Excellent. Thank you for that question. Next one. Next, please. Wow. They're emailing some. Okay, yeah, come on, let's get some from overseas. Because Janine, this is always live stream. We get sort of questions from all over the place. We've had them from Yemen and Syria, and this is Scotland and Austria. If someone has a condition which physically damages the brain, can they still benefit from meditation? Yep. It kind of depends on how damaged the brain is. As many of you know, we have one monk who's clinical schizophrenic, and you wouldn't know. He's living a totally well-balanced life, and I'm sure that many of you don't know who he is. You're probably looking at him. Which one is it? But it's wonderful. Of course, it depends exactly what part of the brain is damaged. Of course, one of the worst damages is to the brain, as I've told you this before, but there's actually a few people can actually become monks. You know, the PhD, the permanent head damage. So we've got a few people with a PhD who become monks and nuns. PhD, that's what it stands for, permanent head damage. So they can meditate as well. In fact, they need to meditate a lot. So, but other, it really depends exactly what damage there is to the brain. Because in Buddhism, you've got the brain, you've got the mind, different things. I remember many, many cases. It always fascinates me, the psychology of the brain and the mind. People, I remember seeing a BBC documentary where a man had lost his short-term memory. He remembered just, you know, how to speak, how to add up, but short-term had totally gone. And he just got remarried. And he couldn't remember his wife, or when he got married, or even what her name was. It was very distressing to his wife. And hypnosis. Under hypnosis, they could actually access his memories. He just actually was rushing for a telephone call the days before mobiles and hit his head on a shutter of the shed where he was at the time. It just literally knocked out his short-term memory. What's fascinating, he could remember under hypnosis, but he could not remember it just outside. So there's damage to the brain, but the memory was stored somewhere. So it really depends on what type of damage you have to the brain. Maybe I'll pass one over to you, so you don't feel left out. Number two.
This is the questions from Paula from Austria. I'm 21 years and been meditating a year. I have no desire to work, continue study or do normal things my age. I want to be a nun, but my parents wouldn't like it. Do you have any advice?
That's right up your street.
Already 21 years old. And we have a quite common even. And actually, usually, some of the advice I give, like, that to become a Buddhist, you're a better person. You become really kind, you're a kinder person, and a very compassionate. And because sometimes I can understand as the parents, they're really worried. They think that you get into all this cult, you know, don't know what you're doing, and wearing all these strange robes, you know, with bald heads, you know, and looks really, you know, that I can understand as the parents, they're really worried. But the fact I said it's important that how we conduct ourselves, you know, and you see, if you become a really beautiful person, caring, compassionate, you know, and then they really have confidence, you know. That's why it's important that you, through your own practice, you know, how your behavior, your conduct, to really convince your parents. This is what is important. Because some people think that, oh, my daughter become a Buddhist, that become worse than before, after they become a Buddhist, isn't it? It's all. I mean, sometimes you have to try to understand them and put your shoes on the other person's shoes. You'll be able to understand others, that as a parent, I can understand how is it like. Because I have a son too. You know, when I decided to become a nun, actually it's difficult, you know. I can see the attachments, the parents towards the children is more than the children towards the parents, I can guarantee you. I know how is it like. So that's why I can understand how the parents feel, you know. They feel like that they're losing their child, you know. Actually not to worry, because a lot of people think that once they become monks or nuns, they are not so, you know, if, you know, like for us, like some of our nuns, if the parents or the mother or the father, whoever sick, they're allowed to go back to look after the parents. Actually, they are not like completely cut off and then they can't go back to visit the families. All the monks and nuns, they used to go back, you know, once in a while to visit the families. And when the parents sick, they went back to look after them. Actually, we can. Actually, the Buddha also encourages us, we have to look after our parents. So So if our parents sick, so they said, don't have to worry, just let your mother, your parents know that even though you become a nun, you still can look after them.
Yeah. And a practical piece of advice, we have something in Buddhism called temporary ordinations. Just you go and just ordain for a short while, just to test it out. So the lady who's asking this question, just tell your mother and father, I'm only going to do this for a short while, just to test it out. But just don't let on what a short while is in Buddhism, because even life is very short. So it could be 30, 40 years. But it just reminds me, the monk sitting next to me, Venerable Nito, his parents never wanted him to become a monk. And so the first time he went to, please correct me if I'm wrong, the first time he went to visit his family in Norway, he showed me the letter from them. He said, yes, you can come and visit, but not in. And I told him to write back saying, it's either robe or naked, take. And anyway, I don't know what the first time, but then you're passed away. Saying, apologize for the passing away. Brother to have family give his that he came up with when it was needed to help a family in the crisis of someone dying prematurely. So for those people in thinking about your daughter, it's a great benefit for the family, and you will find that out whenever there's any crisis in your family. Having a nun or a monk in the family is the greatest blessing. Is that about right? Yeah. Okay.
I think it's good to encourage them to come to stay to, in the monastery. Actually, it's really very useful because some of our nuns, the parents, after visiting the monastery, when they come and spend some time, they can really understand why the daughter wants to become a nun, because they really benefit that. They come when they come to visit, because some of them, they say, why my daughter wants to become a nun? Have I done anything wrong? Is it that she upset with me? They said she become a nun. But afterwards, when they spend some time, they come to visit the nuns, the daughter in the monastery. They spend like a week or so. And they really enjoy, you know, staying in the monastery. And they come to meet our lay supporters. And they listen to all the stories, how the lay supporters benefit, you know, coming to the monasteries, you know. Then they can really see how much we help, you know, being of service and provide the place like a monastery, the peace and calm, and we benefit a lot of people. And this is how it's actually the best thing, actually, to take your parents to the monastery and let them really experience that.
Very good. Okay. Any other question from the back? Yes. People have accidents, yeah. And they're on life support.
And when they're on life support, is it bad karma for the relatives to agree to turn off the life support?
Is it bad karma to turn off the life support? There's been... yes, Munisa is here.
Did she have the experience?
No, yes. Can I tell that experience, Munisa, about your mum?
Yeah, well, she wasn't exactly on life support.
Yeah. But she had Charcot-Coit's disease. Yeah. So that, I'll tell my personal story with her, because when I visited Thailand, her mother had it's called mad cow disease, okay, that's what it usually called. But it was a degeneration of the brain, so she was in the hospital for such a long time. And it just so happened I was visiting Thailand at the time. So, you know, I went to see her. And you know, as a monk, even as a, you, Don, you've done enough meditation, you're sensitive enough. If that was somebody close to you, then just sitting by the bedside for a short while, you should be able to pick up if there's somebody there or not, if they're still alive, or whether it's just an empty body being kept going by the life support. I know in... Please excuse me for telling this, but by your mother's bedside, you know that she was so tired. You could actually feel the exhaustion of fighting that disease, trying to keep her alive for such a long time. And I mentioned that to you. I said that, no, she's at the end. Wasn't it the case, I think, she passed away the next day?
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. So you could actually feel what was going on. And then, you know, I didn't know her, just like being a monk, being able to tune in to what's going on. And that, I've done that so many times, being by the bedside and knowing whether they're still there or not, whether they're still fighting, or whether they've just basically left already. And that's what I ask people to do, actually to do a little bit of silence, be really aware, and you can feel whether that's your father, whether he's still alive or not, whether he's left and the body's an empty shell. The feeling is very different. And if it's an empty shell, and you say turn off the life support system, you're not killing anything. It's just the body being, empty shell being kept alive, you know, just by machines. There's no one in there. And other times you can feel, no, there's someone still in there, which as a Buddhist, it's not your right to terminate somebody's life. It's up to them. It's not you. So that was my advice. And there was, I think you know Angie Monksfield over in Singapore. She's been here. She's my main supporter over in Singapore, organizes everything for me. And her auntie was in a coma. And she survived it, but she told this wonderful story. She told me personally that she was in a very dark space. This is how she described being in a coma. Really, really dark. And what brought her out was the sound of a temple bell. Now, as a Buddhist meditator, it's the sounds which take you out of the deepest states of meditation. It's also why we use alarm bells to take us out from sleep. That sense of sound penetrates very deep, even into comas. So as the sound of a temple bell brought her out into her body, but because of whatever's happened to her anatomy, that she could not speak, she couldn't even move any part of her body, but she could see and hear perfectly. And what she saw was frightening to her, because there was a consultation between the specialist and her sons. Should we turn off the machine? And they asked the doctor, said, look, there's no one there, she's gone already. And she could hear all of this. I'm not gone, I'm here, I can listen. But she couldn't say that or prove it. And then the discussion went, it had to be the sons making that decision. And according to the Chinese tradition, the eldest son had to make the final decision. And he was arguing with his younger siblings, no, don't leave it to me, this is just too important for me, I can't do this. And all the time she was thinking, willing, she said, son, don't turn off the life support, don't. And then he finally said, give her another day. And that's all she said, thank you, son. And that's all she needed, just one day. She started to move some of her limbs enough that the doctor realized that something was happening, a recovery was happening. And she made a full recovery, long, torturous, getting the use of her faculties back again. But it was a very wonderful description of what it's like to be emerging from a coma on life support. And sometimes they're there, but we don't realize it. So that's why I always have to say, please, just sit next to your loved one, just the two of you, and just ask the question, are you there? And often you'll get a very clear answer, and that's what you follow. Practical advice, but it does actually work. Many people have done that. Does that answer your question, Don? It's going to happen to most of us because of the ability to keep people going. Should we not? So that's the practical answer. I'll give a couple from overseas. Here we go. Do you want to do one?
Okay.
From the USA.
Okay. Okay. From Jose in the United States, he's asking, is there such a thing as being taken advantage of as far as being compassionate is concerned? So basically, if you are compassionate, will you be taken advantage of?
I'm taking advantage of you.
That's not compassionate. I don't have a good answer. Pass the buck.
People take advantage of me all the time. That's the meaning of my life. That's my purpose, to be taken advantage of. And I do it willingly. It's nice to be taken advantage of. Here I am, use me. So, but up to a point, because what they're really saying is that, yes, service is an important part of our life, our reason to be here. But you find out you can't serve all that well if you're exhausted and burnt out. So in order to be taken advantage of, you have to realize you have your limited resource. So you have to make use of it wisely. So yes, be compassionate, but always have wisdom as well. Yes, you are taken advantage of, but in myself, in order that I can be taken advantage of tomorrow and the next day, there comes a time I say, now I need to rest, to recharge my batteries, just to have time out. So yes, they did take advantage of you, but to make sure it's only as much as you can give. I was reminded recently of the great story, which I haven't said for such a long time, of the bad snake. And one of the reasons I'm saying this is because a long time ago, Janine, I told this to Peter Costello when he was just a small guy, just an ordinary parliamentarian. Because the Buddhist Society of Victoria, where I go every year in Malvern East, was part of Peter Costello's electorate. So he would come to the openings. And I told him about the bad snake. So once upon a time, there was a very bad, mean, malicious, vicious snake who would bite people for fun. His fun, that is, not theirs. And he was so dangerous that people knew where his hole was and would always avoid it. But towards the end of the bad snake's life, he started to become philosophical, just like all beings. Started to contemplate what happens to snakes when they die. Is there like a heaven for good snakes or a hell for bad snakes? Or do snakes just get reincarnated again? So what happens to snakes? So he started thinking as he was getting towards the end of his life. And so he had heard that not far from his hole, on the top of a hill, there was a holy snake, a religious snake. But he always thought, oh, that religious is just nonsense for people without brains. So he never really wanted to go anywhere near that holy snake, but he decided to check the holy snake out. But in order that he didn't get embarrassed, The bad snake got a raincoat, a fedora hat and sunglasses so no one would recognize him. And he slid up to the top of the hill, where, as it happened, the holy snake was sitting in front of a microphone talking to many people just like you here. And the bad snake just sat in the back next to the door, like most newcomers do. But as the bad snake started to listen, what the holy snake said made a lot of sense. It answered all these questions. He started just getting interested, then fascinated, and look, by the end of the sermon, he was totally inspired and converted. So the bad snake, he took off all his disguise, and people were surprised to see this notorious snake, you know, in the assembly. And the bad snake came right up to the holy snake and confessed all the sins of his life. I've been a terrible snake. I've done such bad things. I've been so mean, but I ask forgiveness, and I will never do it again. I will always be a good snake from now on. I will try and be an example to all other snakes and help the bad snakes become good snakes. I've seen the error of my ways. And as he went out, he gave a donation in coins so everyone could hear them. And when he went back to his hole, he decided to become a vegetarian. He joined Greenpeace, Amnesty International, and World Wildlife Fund. He was a good snake now, and keeping what we call in Buddhism the five precepts: not killing, stealing, committing adultery, lying, or taking alcohol. He never took alcohol anyway, but you know, he just kept that one anyway. It comes with the set. So there he was, by his hole. And whenever anybody went past, they still didn't really know. They didn't know he had changed, even though he had a big Greenpeace sign on his chest. Still they didn't know he'd changed his ways, until one day a kid was walking past, totally mindful, playing computer games on his iPhone, and almost stepped on that bad snake. And the snake never bit. He was just sitting there cross-coiled in meditation with a holy smile on his face. And from that time on they realized the snake wasn't dangerous anymore. The snake became a pacifist, and everyone got to know about that. But what happens with pacifists? Sometimes people take advantage of you. They know you're kind. And so with some kids. Some kids came along and they abuse that snake. What type of snake do you think you are? You are a disgrace to your species. You're not real snake, you're just an oversized worm, that's all you are. You creep. Show us your fangs if you've got any. And that really hurt. This was a very proud snake. And that snake, you could bite any of those kids in a flash before you could say, well, Wildlife Fund, which takes a long time anyway, so it's not really that fast. But he couldn't, because of his vows of non-violence. So the kids took advantage of him. They started throwing stones and clods of earth at that snake. And some of those stones hit, and they hurt. And because the snake couldn't respond, the kids grew even bolder, and they had sticks, and they whacked that snake on the back with a stick. And the poor snake just could not respond. He couldn't bite them because of his vows. He just had to take that beating. At the end of the beating, he realized, all this religious stuff is nonsense. How can you be kind, be compassionate, and keep precepts in this world when most other people don't? They just take advantage of you. So the bad snake crawled painfully up the hill to see the holy snake, to get released from his vows. And when the holy snake saw him coming, all bruised and bloodied, the holy snake, what has happened to you? And the bad snake, it's your fault. What do you mean it's my fault? Your fault, you religious nutcase. What are you talking about, said the holy snake. You told me to keep these precepts and not bite anybody. Look what's happened to me. You can't keep these rules. You can't be a pacifist and a vegetarian and a member of the World Wildlife Fund. People just take advantage of you. And at that, the holy snake said, you stupid snake. You idiot snake. You imbecile snake. It is very true. I told you not to bite, but I never told you not to hiss. And that's all the snake needed to do. A hiss. And those kids would have run a mile. So, in politics, Janine, you do not need to bite, but you can hiss. And then people will leave you alone. So that's the story of the bad snake. So even snakes, if they're vegetarian, they're non-violent, they can still hiss to make sure they're not taken advantage of. It's okay to hiss every now and again. Okay, I'll do one from France. Can you give some advice to children around 7 or 8 years old on how to deal with bullies at school and at home from their father? Oh, that's not very good. No escape. At school they get it and at home they get it. Look, if it's really bullies at home, that you can't just... And kids, you know, hissing is not good enough. So you have to actually to do something. Bullies at school, you have to talk to the teacher first of all. And because many people have been bullied when they were young, and that does create a huge amount of emotional problems, learning difficulties, and even self-esteem later on in life. So I know that one of the reasons for bullying is, again, hierarchies. Whenever there is a hierarchy, people of more physical power or more emotional power or organizational power, when there's a power, there will always be some people at the top of that power structure who will abuse those at the lower end of the structure. Unfortunately, that's part of that is human nature. We try to stop that, but one practical way is of trying, if possible, to lessen the hierarchies. So even in schools, they don't have a huge gap of physical strength, you know, from, say, grade 7s to grade 12s. Grade 12s are huge compared to grade 7s. The physical power is much, much stronger. Segregation, if you possibly could. So that would lessen the possibility of bullying. Hierarchical structures, you know, in organizations. Because if someone is at the top, they have the opportunity to misuse their power for people in the bottom. So restructuring our organizations so the hierarchies are not people of immense power and people of low power, even in schools, physical power. And of course, a father or a mother, huge strong person, a 7 or 8 year old, that is very, very difficult. So that's where, you know, in this lady comes from France, that you really do need, you know, to see somebody, a sociologist, or even, you know, your start maybe with your school principal to actually to talk about this so that the father does get some counselling so that bullying is just not on. You may love your kids, but this is no way to treat your children from bullies. But it's also, you know, somehow in our organisation we have to lessen people's power so that they're not free, even in offices, bosses, to bully. Too much power is encouraging. It makes it possible for bullies to occur. Okay, one for you here. Very good. I can pass it down to the next one if you wish to. Have a read of it first. If you don't like it, pass it down. Can't hear.
Twice one.
This is Linda from Singapore. I have been living in the present with no wants or needs. In hindsight, I feel as though I have made no substantial progress in life and lost my passion for everything. How can I live a better life and find my purpose?
Easy one.
I think if you're really living in present moment, actually, you have lots of joy and happiness. And it seems that this, Linda, it seems like if you're really living in the present moment, you don't have that feelings. It seems like, you know, sometimes people letting go. Actually, they're not really letting go. They're attached to letting go. Sometimes we attach to being in present moment, but actually we are not really living in present moment. If you're really living in present moment, actually you have lots of joy and happiness. It's not like it seems that now she has like very low energy, like don't feel like doing anything. And actually it's not the case. I think a lot of people think that, oh, I let go of everything. I remember sometimes ago someone told me that, oh, I like to tidy my room. I like cleanliness and I attach to that. Now on, I'm not going to tidy my room. I'm not going to clean my room. I said, this is not letting go. You know, doesn't mean that, you know, a lot of people tend to become like, can't be bothered, you know, that they swing from one end to another. That's like middle way. That's like if you're able, the middle way actually is the wisdom. You have to develop the wisdom. So if you really be able to focus and you're really living present moment awareness, actually you have lots of energy. When this energy actually leads you to peace and calm. And it's different. It's not like attached to being letting go. I'm being in present moment. But actually they're not really in present moment. They think that they're in present moment, but they think they're getting rid of things. I remember someone told me that that one of the friends that this person first become a Buddhist, this person let go of everything, sell all the furniture and everything and just sleep on the floor because of that, said live simply. And then later find out that being a Buddhist is too difficult and then they don't want to become a Buddhist anymore. Then a lot of people that said letting go is, this is not what letting go, you know, is that the letting go of what you attach within yourself, you know, the attachment is not the object. So a lot of people thinking that the surrounding, the object is a problem. Actually, it's not the object, it's a problem. How we react to that, what we're holding on within us is a problem. That's like, I have really doubt, and this person is really always living in this present moment awareness. But I think if those of you have experience in meditation, you know, practice, you know that, isn't it, when you're fully present, actually you have lots of joy and happiness. It's not that with no energy, you know. So what Ajahn Brahm you like to say? So Ajahn Brahm let go. So I'm letting go too. Okay. So any questions or comments? Yes, I remember I have someone that I know that this person never keep any money and she use every single cent, you know. And until when she's really like a stove, you know, need to repair whatever things that need emergency, she has no money. So we try to tell this person, no, you have to keep some money for yourself. Oh, I'm living in present moment, I don't worry about future, you know. And this is how sometimes people, you know, attached to being, you know, letting go, but they're not really letting go. Okay. Any questions? No more questions, Ajahn. So I let it go, Ajahn.
Okay. Next question. Okay. Ah, the president. Whoa. Yeah, okay.
Maybe this is a hard one, hopefully for Venerable Nito. Uh-huh. Give him some practice.
Yes, there we go. Oops.
I'm in trouble.
So we've got some contact with the military and the Australian Defence Force, and they're considering maybe implementing a Buddhist chaplain. And one of our members is flying over to Sydney soon to join a panel to discuss this. So they have a Christian, Christian, Anglican, Muslim, and now they're considering a Buddhist chaplain. And this particular person was chatting to me and saying, well, how do we reconcile being a Buddhist chaplain? So this person would just be sort of part-time on call. They wouldn't become a Defence Force member. But how do we reconcile the five precepts and not killing and giving advice as a Buddhist chaplain for soldiers in places like Afghanistan where they're pulling the trigger? And I guess what he's getting at is, is there any legitimacy in having a Buddhist chaplain in the military because of the, I guess, the pacifist nature of Buddhism? But then on the other hand, if we don't have a military chaplain, those people in the Defence Force, I guess, are, they're on their own. Over to you. Is that hard enough?
I guess we have a precept not to kill. And then if you're going to be some kind of advisor in wars, that's a big problem. But there are other factors as well when it comes to conflicts and wars. And if there's like a Buddhist counselor there, he can be somebody who's trying to minimize conflicts and minimize killing as much as possible. But there are other precepts as well, which can be highlighted. I think in general, a Buddhist counselor can give us as good advice as a Christian priest. And I think they have the same problems. Like in Christianity, they also teach not to kill. And they're trying to be kind. So I don't see any problems with kind of a Buddhist monk or a Buddhist representative to be a counsel in war.
Yeah, that's sort of the conversation we had where we said, well, actually, Ten Commandments are don't kill. And Christian chaplains have been involved in the military since day dot, and the Buddhist counselor or chaplain can be there to reduce conflict and basically be a counselor. Yeah. But there's always going to be that conflict with people who, I guess, if you're, well, Buddhist countries have militaries, and then you join the military, the police force, and then you're in the firing line, and what do? You don't have a military. That's not a reality. So I guess there's always a bit of a grey area, and I suppose that Buddhist chaplain, if they do get involved in the Australian Defence Force, they would just try and mediate, I suppose, rather than lay down the law of thou shalt not kill and to discharge.
I don't think it's possible to stop. If somebody in the past, even the Buddha, time of the Buddha, there were all kind of wars going on between the kings and the republics, and he couldn't stop them. Even his own kind of people, when he died, were massacred by some warriors. I think it was like in the same state. So even somebody like, which is so developed, like the Buddha, if he cannot stop war, I don't think we can. But we can try to make the best out of it. And we can try to negotiate, try to give advice, and try to minimize everything which is wrong and bad.
Good answer. Thank you.
Any other questions? I did actually notice that I think it's Costa Rica. Yeah, you know, Costa Rica. It does not have a military at all. No army, no navy, no air force. and they put all their money, which they would send in the military, into education. Is that correct, isn't it? Yeah. It's amazing. They're a small country, and so they know that whatever army they have is not going to be effective. It's interesting that they're managing to survive quite well without an army. Miriam from Mexico. Mexico is mostly a Catholic country. How can I explain my Buddhist beliefs to people in a simple way? It's just on Thursday. We had a wonderful meeting in Dharmasala Monastery with the Benedictine Catholic monks. And if you could see us interacting together, you wouldn't believe that these were two different religions. They're just such friendship, such honesty and kindness and compassion together. So, again, Mexico is actually, there's no country which is Catholic or Christian. Countries aren't religious, people are. So when everyone says that Thailand or Sri Lanka is a Buddhist country, I say no. People are Buddhists, not countries. Because, of course, you know in Sri Lanka there is many of other religions as well. So Mexico has got lots of Catholics. It's not a Catholic country. And also, Buddhism beliefs, simple things like compassion and kindness and wisdom, respect and peace. Or you may go with that, my definition of God, which again I wrote about in a book. And that came again thinking about the Benedictine monks with a seminar which I had with Abbot Placid, the former abbot of New Norcia Monastery, passed away a few years ago, over at UWA, where I was asked that question by Father Frank Brennan. And he is a very strong intellectual with a huge nationwide reputation. So when he asked the question, what is the Buddhist idea of God? I was going on to their perceptual framework. And he said, what is the Buddhist idea of God? And I knew I could not tell a joke to someone like Father Frank Brennan. That wouldn't go down very well. This was a serious question. And I came up with an answer which I was very pleased with. I said, well, my friend, Abbot Placid, who I've had many wonderful discussions with over the years, he told me that one of his core beliefs was everyone is searching for God. Now, as a Buddhist, I'm not going to react against that and say, we don't believe in God. I'm going to respect that statement and see how I can make use of that. So I said, I'm going to respect that statement. Everyone is searching for God. So what do Buddhists search for? What are you searching for today? For peace? For truth? You know, the ability to be respected? And to give that respect to others, you know, for love, whichever way you see it, and the ability to love others, the privilege to love others, for kindness, for meaning, truth, whatever you wish to call it. That's what Buddhists are searching for, that's what atheists are searching for. So if everyone is searching for God, and that's where what Buddhists are searching for, and atheists are searching for, and I would say Catholics are searching for as well, for the ability or to love another person and the joy of being loved, of being respected, of peace, stillness, meaning. If that's what we're all searching for, and my friend says everyone is searching for God, then that's what God must mean. And straight away, that takes away the barriers between different faiths, different religions. And that's why Father Frank Brennan said that's a great answer. And I was actually very pleased with that, because it's not an answer which, you know, you can get from the scriptures. It's an answer you get from the heart, which actually does mean that Buddhism in Mexico is respected. Whether you're a Catholic or a Buddhist, what we're trying to aim for is inner peace. Aren't Catholics trying to do the same? Are we not, we're trying to be respected
and to give respect to other people, no matter who they are, what race, what religion, sexual orientation, to give and receive respect. Even if we have some disability, physical or mental disability, we want respect, understanding, peace, contentment. What are you searching for? If everyone is searching for God, that must mean what God is, and that's where the religions can come together. So try that out in your Catholic country. Explain the Buddhist meaning of God. And then they say, wow, there's no difference between us, no barriers. The words, the concepts are the barriers. But the feelings in a human heart, they are common. The spiritual path is not a path of ideas. It's of emotions. Peace, stillness, it's not an idea. It's an emotion, something you feel and experience. But if we stop at the descriptions, then we have arguments. And then Buddhism is one thing, Catholicism is another thing. So see if we can get past those. That's part of what I was talking about last Friday. So, maybe Miriam, that might work for you. Okay. That's 4 o'clock. That's the end. Time goes so fast when you're enjoying yourself. So, now the next part of today's is introduction, felicitation, short talks by pioneering members of the Buddhist Society. We've been here, I think came 1974, and it was already a functioning Buddhist society, only very small. We have grown along, and we've grown greatly since 1974, and so have I. I have grown with the Buddhist Society. So, Mr. President, would you like to say a few words? Actually, this, how many pioneering members have we got here? We've only got Bud and Chandra, haven't we? Any more? Just Bud and Chandra? Yeah. Okay. Look, maybe, Mr. President, okay if just Janine could say a few words? Yeah. Yeah, just come from the heart. Okay. Because, you know, she's not a pioneering member, but she has actually helped out several times. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Always enjoy the fact that you do this to me, Ajahn Brahm, that I come along to celebrate and suddenly I'm speaking. Can I please acknowledge the traditional owners on the land on which we meet, the Whadjuk people of the Noongar Nation, their elders past and present. And I do that as a member of Parliament because it's so important when we look at where we are at the present time and look forward to a prosperous future that we understand and respect our history. And that's what you're about to do when you're talking about, you know, the people who were foundation members of the Buddhist Society. It's 1974. I'm not sure you were here. Were you here in 1974 in Nolamara? Was that the case then?
No, 87.
Oh, North Perth. Okay, in 87 here. I got elected in 2008. I worked for a period of time with members of the Buddhist Society who told me that I needed to go up to Jarrodale. And and they took me up to Jarrodale to meet the Ajahn Brahm. And he, I can remember driving up there. It was during an election. And I can remember driving up there thinking, I'm taking a whole day out of election time. It's a crazy, time of where you basically have to meet as many people as possible and, sell yourself. You know, it's a bit like a big personality contest, even though it should be a political contest and a contest of policies, and it should be a contest. It should be an issue around in terms of what you're offering into the future. But often, in politics, unfortunately. It does become a thing about you as an individual. And so I can remember going up there, this is, and meeting Ajahn Brahm, and he just gave me this great sense of calmness about the whole thing. Like, actually, I don't, you know, the outcome will be the outcome. I just have to present myself to people, and I just have to talk about the things that I believe in, and talk about the issues that are important to me and why I want to represent people. And then I have to hand it over to the community and they make the choice. I have to not, you know, get really, you know, tied up in the whole thing about, oh, God, what happens if I fail? What happens if I fail? And I'm sure in your history, in terms of the strength and the growth of the Buddhist Society in Western Australia and, you know, monastery and the nuns' monastery, is that you probably have done the same thing. You've just relied on the fact that, you know, you do the work that you do and the people get to, make those decisions. And strangely enough, when you do that, when you say to people, I want to give you that capacity, people get involved, and clearly you've got lots of people involved, and you're very well respected and well loved in the community, and we're very grateful. One of the other things he told me the first time I met him was that he was very good friends with Jeff Gallop, which is extraordinarily, and that he had quite a bit to do with Jeff Gallop, who was the Premier up until a few years before that 2008 election. And so that was, that was pretty amazing for me, because Jeff Gallop was a very considered and respected politician that someone like me, a young politician, looked up to, you know, because you do, you know, you're going into a field that is full of people who are disliked, and so it's very nice to respect and look at people who are liked in the community. That was certainly great. And the hissing story, I will remember that. That's a very good one. Can I finish this? And you may remember it differently, but I do tell this story. So I got elected, and every now and again when things when you needed assistance, you would give me a call. And I tell the story that I was a newly elected Member of Parliament, and I got this phone call from the Ajahn Brahm. I tell it to other people, you know, the head of the Buddhist Society in Western Australia and their spiritual leader. And he said to me, Janine, I'm stressed. And I was like, hello, I'm the politician and I'm getting a phone call from a Buddhist monk telling me he's stressed. Okay, I'm up for this. The electricity was about to be turned off here, because they were doing some work around here in Nolimara. And you were doing a wedding?
Oh, yes.
A
wedding? And I didn't even know Buddhists did weddings, so, you know, it was all new to me as well. And I can remember we sorted it. But it was a great story for me, and I do tell it a lot, the time that a Buddhist monk rang me and said he was stressed and I could help him out. I was very proud of myself. Thank you very much. I got attached to that story. So thank you very much. You are a great, your society and you and the nuns and the monks are greatly appreciated here. Years ago, 20 years, no, more than 20 years ago, I was a young university student who suffered my first migraine, and my boyfriend at the time said to me, you can't do this. You can't have migraines. My mother had had them. My grandmother had had them. And so we went along to learn TM, Transcendental Meditation. And one of the things that the TM practitioners said was that there had been studies, and I don't know if this is true or not, whether they tell this story, that in pockets of America where they have really large communities of meditators, the crime is lower than in other parts of the US. And so I always think that this little pocket of Nolimara must be a very serene and lovely place, and it always is for me to visit, and so I thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Janine. So we have one founding member here. Is that correct, Ajahn Brahm?
Well, two there.
Two?
Okay, yeah.
So,
Radha and Chandra.
There's a microphone. Great.
Yeah.
So perhaps we could just have a story about how you got involved in the Buddhist society and how you've seen it grow. Thanks.
Can I sit and talk? Venerable sirs and Kunis, my name is very, very long, and when I first came here, my name is Buddhadasa, and the staff called me Buddha. I said, don't call me Buddha, because he was the greatest human being ever lived on this earth. I am, his dasa means servant. So don't call me. So they started, what shall we call you? They said, we can call you Bud. So 2 days later, I went to the library, and in the library, I was seated, and 3 ladies were reading a book, and they were reading the name Annana Kondana. And I laughed, and they turned around and said, what's wrong with you? I said, you were pronouncing the greatest monk, the very first monk name wrong. What is it? It's Anya Kondanya. Oh, how do you know? I said, I'm a Buddhist. Are there Buddhists here? No, there are no Buddhists here. So, that made me think that we should become starting the Buddhist society. And my membership number is number 3. And we started the Buddhist society, and I was the very first Buddhist who entered this premises. This was a church, but this building, that building there. And one of my friends told me there is a church hall for sale. So I rang up Ajahn Jagaro, and he said, let's go and see it. So 3 of us came. Ajahn Jagaro and another gentleman, he passed away last year, and myself. So I am the first Buddhist to step in here. And when we got out of that place, there was a road there. Still that road is there. And when he came to there, I told Ajahn Jagaro, turned around and said, we have to buy this place. I said, we have no money. That doesn't matter, we have to buy it. You are a difficult man. If we don't do that, we have to do this. So that was the beginning of the thing. And yes, a couple of years later, he managed to get the Buddhist center extended further to a very large area where the monks are there and the nuns are there. So, I am very proud that I am here, but unfortunately during the last few years, both my wife and my health have deteriorated badly, and we are unable to come as much as we did before. My membership still remains the very top member. Thank you for listening. May
And was there one more founding member? Ah, of course.
So, what is your membership number, Chandra? What's Chandra's membership number? A 3. Oh, okay. Very good. Okay. So, what we do now is have a break for 15 minutes, and at 4:30 we have the 5 precept ceremony for new members, and at this time we have many online who will be joining in at 4:30, because there's many places in the world which don't have an active Buddhist society like we do, so that we invite people on our WaySack Day to take the 5 precepts online, so they'll be actually looking in that the other end of that camera and taking the 3 refuges and the 5 precepts together with those who are taking the 3 refuges and 5 precepts for the first time. See? Oh, that's right, yes. There's one of the other early members, Mr. Warren Smales, and he was actually the president when I first arrived here. But he did come this morning to drop in and to say hello with his son, Sven. And but unfortunately, that he's had to go back. He's getting old. Do you remember Warren Smales? Bud? Warren Smales. Do you remember him? One of the presidents. Along when I first came 33 years ago, he was the president, Mr. Warren Smales. No, don't remember him. You probably would if you saw him. Does the name ring a bell?
Yes, I think I...
Yeah. If you saw him, you'd probably remember him. He's not that different. Excellent. Okay. But when you get old, it doesn't mean that you're losing your memory. When you get old, especially the number of years you've been a Buddhist and I've been a Buddhist, you live in the present moment. So you've let go of the past. So it is, you're achieving just what Buddhists are supposed to be. In the present moment, forgetting the past. Well done. Okay, so take a break for 15 minutes. Yeah. And then please come back at 5:30. Because many people will be online at that time, just waiting to actually to do the ceremony for the new Buddhists. And thank you, monks and nuns. Awesome.